nous allons passer maintenant à la présentation suivante. On est à peu près dans les temps. Et la présentation suivante sera donnée par Christina Alberini, qui est professeure de neurosciences à Mount Sinai School of Medicine à New York. Et elle nous parlera justement de ces mécanismes de reconsolidation auxquels on a fait allusion dans notre présentation. Le titre est « The Dynamics of Our Internal Representations, Memory Consolidation, Reconsolidation and the Integration of New Information with the Past ».
I know, that's always the effect. Thank you very much, Pierre. I like to start by thanking Professor Magistretti for inviting me to this wonderful meeting and all the organizers. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. And is also, I think, a very important meeting that will pioneer changes in the way we think about questions in neuroscience and psychoanalysis. What I'm going to try to do is to give you some summary of studies going on in the lab, which are about memory and how dynamics the process of memories are, and hopefully some link that can be useful for psychoanalytic thinking. First of all, memory is a biologically fundamental function. Without memories, we cannot defend ourselves from danger, find good sources of food, and take care of our children and our families. But memories are also who we are. It's part of our identity, as memory and identity are inseparable. So we are all afraid of losing our memories because we are afraid of losing our identity. Okay. I think the videos are not working, sorry. I had a brief video here, so I'm going to tell you what it was. Unless we try to see if it's going to work. I had a brief video showing how devastating memory loss is. This is a case that lost his memories because of a stroke. And not only he lost the memories of the past, so he has retrograde amnesia, but also anterograde amnesia, cannot form new memories. And it's really devastating to hear and to see what this type of amnesia do. These type of memories are the so-called long-term memories. And long-term memories are memories that become part of our identity, that are maintained for sometimes as long as a lifetime. But actually, as our friend, poet and novelist Cesare Pavese says, most of the experiences we go through out every day, in the everyday life, are forgotten. We do not remember days, we remember moments. The richness of life lies in memories we have forgotten. So what is it that the brain selects to become long-term memories, the memories that become part of our identity? Which experience become a long-lasting memory and how? How stable or changeable are long-term memories? First of all, I want to make a distinction, remind here that there are the memories comes in different shapes and flavors. And one major distinction is between declarative types of memories and procedural types of memories. Declarative memories are memories of facts, people, and things. They can be consciously discussed and declared. The memories that we talk about. And procedural memories are memories of skills and procedures. They are implicit. They are the memories of how to do things, how to ride a bike, how to play piano, tie a shoe, and so on. And today we're going to talk about declarative type of memories, actually animal models that model some aspect of these types of memories. So memories of facts, people, and things, who we are, our friends, families, and relationships. So what makes a declarative type of memory long-lasting? Emotionally charged or salient events are known to be much better remembered. And this is intuitive, we all experience that, but there's also a large literature showing that, in fact, when an experience is linked to an emotionally strong feeling, they are much better remembered. And the emotions can be positive or negative. They can be pleasure and excitement, or they can be pain and sadness. But as long as there is an emotional link to it, memory is going to become long-term and remembered. And in the chapter of painful type of experiences, there is an important part that is trauma. Traumatic events are remembered. Even single traumatic events can be remembered for a lifetime. We all experience this type of memories. Where were you when September 11 attack occurred? And we all remember that. We remember where we were, with whom, what we talk about, the smell, the sounds, and a lot of details around those days. So shock, trauma, but also extreme pleasures, strong pleasures, those are the important ingredients for long-lasting memories. And interestingly, the first one who discussed, who elaborated about traumatic memories is Freud. And he, in fact, was, I believe, the first to come up with the term Erinnerungsspur, which literally means trace of a memory. And we have heard a lot about it already. And it's interesting how he actually defined, he believed that the memory trace is unconscious, but the memory of it becomes conscious, and becomes conscious through a sensory manifestation that gives rise to symptoms. So he was very interested in understanding the distortion of memories that comes from trauma. And also what they found is a very interesting elaboration of the memory traces and how dynamic memories are. In a letter to Fliess in 1896, Freud says, "Our psychic mechanism has come into being by a process of stratification. The material present in the form of memory traces being subjected from time to time to a rearrangement in accordance to fresh circumstances, to a retranscription. Memory is present not once, but several times over." And we're going to see something that is related to this in our experiments that we are currently doing. So we want to know where memory traces are. And in neuroscience, we do call, in fact, these memory traces, or engram. And very similarly to Freud, for us, a memory trace is a physical modification in the brain that comes from experience and can be later recalled. So where are memory traces? Well, I cannot give you a definite answer to that, but we know that there is not a specific region where memories are stored. But they seem to be stored throughout the brain, in many brain regions. And the process by which memories are formed and stored is the synaptic plasticity that we have heard about. So changes, long-term changes in synaptic strength. And another function, biologically important, of memory, which is not only to retrieve the past, is to incorporate selectively information of the present into our past, so that the memories are not compartmentalized, but continuously changing and integrating new experiences. So what do we know, and what are the questions that we are trying to address in neuroscience? Well, a century of research has shown that before becoming a long-lasting memory, the new learning is in a lay-by state. So following learning the new information is in a lay-by state for some time. But over time, this information becomes less and less lay-by, and so more and more stable until it is insensitive to disruption. And the process by which this memory becomes stronger and stronger and resistant to disruption is called memory consolidation. And many different types of studies in different species and types of learning have shown that consolidation can be disrupted, therefore during this labile phase, by different types of treatments. Interferences such as pharmacological treatments, and particularly important for the molecular neuroscientists like I am part of, is the inhibition of protein or RNA synthesis. So if we apply RNA or protein synthesis inhibitors around the time of training or immediately after, long-term memories do not form. We have an amnesia. We also have other types of interferences, like, for example, firing inactivation by tetrodotoxin, or brain cooling, or seizure, brain trauma, and even new learning. So a number of interferences applied around the time of training or immediately after when memory is in this lay-by state will interfere with the consolidation process, so long-term memories are not formed. All these studies led to the so-called classical consolidation hypothesis. It was believed until very recently that memory consolidation occurs only once. It's a unitary process. Once memory is consolidated, it's strong and resistant to disruption. And it will stay there, unless there is forgetting, obviously, stored, and it will be retrieved when needed. However, more recently, it has been rediscovered, reproposed, that an established memory, so a memory that has become stable already, can become labile again if it is recalled or retrieved. In other terms, reactivated, brought back to an active state. And like during the consolidation phase at the beginning of memory formation, it again requires protein synthesis and RNA synthesis in order to be preserved. So most of actually the disruptive interferences that I have described for consolidation also disrupt the reconsolidation process, the process of restabilization of the memory after it is retrieved. And in fact, because of the same interferences disrupt a new memory as well as a retrieved memory, this process has been called reconsolidation. And the pioneers of this interest that came back again recently, actually starting in the late, close to the year 2000, were two labs, one here in Paris, led by Susan Sara, and the second by a lab in New York at NYU by Karim Nader and Joe Ledoux. And these studies have been followed by many, many others since then, and in many different species and types of learning, we see that memories become labile if they are reactivated, for example, by retrieval. So this led to changing the hypothesis of how memory becomes stable. And we have now the reconsolidation hypothesis that says that every time a memory is recalled or reactivated, active again, it becomes labile and needs to undergo another process of consolidation. It turns out that actually this is not correct. We're going to see this in a minute, but sort of. Why is this important? Well, first of all, we want to understand how memories are formed, how they become stable and stored over time. Second, we have an opportunity here to disrupt memories after they are stabilized, after they have been formed and become stable, by reactivating them. Because they become labile, if there is this phase of fragility, we have an opportunity to disrupt the memories by interfering with the processes that restabilizes the memory. And this is important for, obviously, clinical applications like post-traumatic stress disorders, phobia, depression, trauma. anything that is linked to a memory that has some pathological result. And third, and this is in no way order, we obviously want to know whether we can change in a controlled fashion some components of the memories by reactivating selectively specific components. And this is obviously important for psychotherapeutic approaches. Okay, so we're going to start, and this is the questions are on, that are ongoing and we're interested in my lab, to ask, what is memory reconsolidation? Why does memory become labile after retrieval? And what is the function of the reconsolidation process? So we're going to ask which brain circuits and molecular mechanisms are involved in post-training and post-retrieval stabilization. What is the effect of time? Is a young memory similarly disruptible as an old one? And what is the function of this post-retrieval labile phase? And to do that, we use an animal model in rat. Let's see if this video works. Okay. We use this shuttle box. There are two compartments. One is lit and the other is dark. The rat is placed into the lit compartment. This is a safe compartment. There is a door that's going to open in a few seconds. And the rat is going to just walk right in because they are interested in seeing what's on the other side. The door closes, and it's going to get a mild foot shock. This is a fear conditioning type of memory. The rat learns about a context that is associated now with a painful experience. It got a shock in the dark part of the chamber, and it's going to remember that. This is a single trial learning. It will remember perfectly. So when then... next, we go back and test whether the animal has a memory at any time point, whenever is that we need to do that. The animal is placed back into the lead compartment. The door opens after a few seconds. And as you can see, we'll avoid the dark side. I'm going to stay here for a few seconds to show you the behavior of the animals. They really is going to poke in and come back. And then it shows typical behavior of anxiety. It will start grooming. Okay, so as you can see, we'll avoid the dark side of the chamber. And the latency can be actually very long. So we count up to 9 minutes of latency, showing that this is a very strong memory. If they don't go into the dark part of the chamber within 9 minutes, then they are taken back to their home cages. The reason why we have chosen this task is because, we want to model traumatic type of memories, the fear conditioning aspect of the trauma. And also we know a great deal about these memories. For example, we know some of the regions involved. We know that this memory requires an intact hippocampus that processes the contextual information. And we know also that it requires an intact amygdala that processes the fear and the stress response linked to the fear conditioning. So which brain regions and molecular mechanisms are involved in the post-training and post-retrieval memory stabilization, and are they the same? To do that, we have taken advantage of knowledge of molecular mechanism identified as essential for long-term memory formation in invertebrate animals, such as Aplysia and Drosophila. And we know that one of the mechanisms, the cascade of events, molecular events required for this type of for memories in invertebrates, is the activation of the gene expression regulated by the transcription factor, which are proteins regulating the expression of genes, known as CREB, saccharine P response element binding protein, which in turn regulates the expression of other transcription factors, more proteins that regulate subsequent gene expression, and this factor is known as CEBP. And studies have shown that, for example, well, both of them, but we're going to focus on CBP, that CBP function is essential for long-term memory formation in invertebrates. So we took advantage of that, and we're going to ask the question of whether if we disrupt the function of this transcription factor in regions of the brain important for the fear conditioning type of learning I've shown, do we see an effect? In other words, is this also required for long-term memory consolidation and reconsolidation in vertebrates, in mammalian systems? So what we're going to do is to disrupt functionally this transcription factor into the hippocampi first, bilaterally of rats that are going to undergo the training I just showed you. And the way we do it, we implant cannulas that target these specific regions. So through the cannulas, we're going to inject a reagent that is a small sequence, DNA sequence, that blocks the expression, the translation, the expression of this factor, meaning it blocks the end, at the end of this manipulation. What we are blocking is the function of this protein, this factor. So what we do is to inject this reagent that functionally blocks CBP in the hippocampi, and you can see here the distribution is throughout the dorsal hippocampus after the injection, and the presence, the time that this disruption lasts is quite brief. 2 hours after injection is very evident, but 8 hours later is basically undetectable. So we're just disrupting for a very short time the function of this protein in the hippocampi of these rats. And then we're going to ask the question, if we do that before or after training at different times, what happens to memory? So we're going to look at memory consolidation here, the new memory. And what happens, these are the group data. What we found is that if we inject these reagents, if we block CBP beta in the hippocampi 1 hour before training, and we test memory always 2 days after training, 48 hours later, what we see is that memory is very strong. This, we have a latency of almost 500 seconds. So there is a very strong memory, which is normal memory. However, when we disrupt the function of this protein 5 hours after training, memory is down here, down to acquisition time, few seconds. The animals walk right in. They have no memory whatsoever that they have received a shock 2 days before. And in yellows, you see the control rats that are injected with similar reagents, but that they are not specific for this protein, so that they don't have a functional, they cannot functionally block the protein. And if we do the same manipulation 24 hours after training, what we see is a significant impairment of the latency of memory. The controls are obviously fine. And if we inject this reagent, if we block the CBP 46 hours after training, and we test 2 hours later, there is no effect on memory. So bottom line, we have framed a time window during which this factor, CBP beta, is essential in the hippocampus for the consolidation of this memory. And the major effect is around 5 hours after training. So the question is, what happens if we do the same thing after memory retrieval? Do we disrupt the reconsolidation of this memory? And in order to do that, we have to show that there is a reconsolidation of this memory. And the way we do it is by injecting protein synthesis inhibitors systemically after the retrieval of the memory. So the animals are trained, 2 days later are tested, and then they receive a systemic injection of anisomycin, which is a protein synthesis blocker, and then they are tested again 2 days later. And as you can see here, this is the acquisition time. This is the memory at test one, 2 days after training, which is intact, obviously. And the animals that receive protein synthesis inhibitors immediately after, they have an impaired memories. And this is contingent upon reactivation. If we do the same treatment excluding the reactivation, the retrieval of the memory, memory is significant and not significantly different from controls, from test one. And obviously, the animals that are injected with vehicle solution instead of anisomycin R have a normal memory. So, yes, we do have a reconsolidation of this memory, which is called inhibitory avoidance memory. And now the question is, if we disrupt CBP-beta, that factor, in the hippocampus 5 hours after retrieval, do we disrupt the reconsolidation? And the answer is no. So the animals that underwent training and then testing, and by testing we retrieve the memory, obviously, and 5 hours later receive the CBP-beta blocker, have a normal memory, no different from unoperated animals. So the next question we had to address is whether protein synthesis at all is required in the hippocampus for the reconsolidation of this memory. And so we repeated the same experiment now by blocking protein synthesis altogether in the hippocampi after the retrieval of the memory. And what we found is that even in this case, there is no effect. Memory is normal. While if we block protein synthesis immediately after training, so if we look at the consolidation process, we do block the formation of a new memory. And this is, was just to confirm data that have been shown before. We knew that. So the first conclusion is that in inhibitory avoidance, in this type of memory, the brain regions that are critically involved in the protein synthesis-dependent process of consolidation are not similarly involved during reconsolidation. So reconsolidation is not a repetition of the consolidation process, but the circuits, the brain regions involved, are different, at least in this type of memories. And obviously, you're going to see that some regions are common and some are different. So second question, what is the effect of time on memory stabilization? When we reason that time is important, memory over time becomes more and more stable. So what happens if we retrieve a memory 2 days after training, or 7 days after training, or 2 weeks after training, or 4 weeks after training, and then we give protein synthesis inhibitors to disrupt these reactivated memories? So in this experiment, we train a group of animals, and then we divide them in four groups. One is going to be undergo a retrieval 2 days after training, the other 7 days, 2 weeks, and 4 weeks after training. And immediately after the retrieval, they are going to be injected with the protein synthesis inhibitors systemically. And then they're going to be tested 2 days later. And what we found is that only very recent memories, 2 days memories, this is a test one and this is memory at test two, only these memories are disrupted. At 7 days also there is a significant disruption, and disruption is always contingent upon reactivation. These are the vehicle controls that have no effect. But when memories become older, like a 2 weeks or a 4 weeks memory, then there is no effect. So we retrieve the memory, we block protein synthesis, but there is no effect. That means that the older the memory is, the more resistant to the reconsolidation effect it becomes. And the same effect was seen also when we targeted amygdala, the other region, the region that processes fear. So now we are going to inject the protein synthesis inhibitors into the amygdala after the retrieval, the reactivation of the memory. And if we do that 2 days after training, we see the memory is impaired, contingent upon reactivation. These are the controls. But if we do that to a memory that is 2 weeks old, there is no effect. So we repeated also by targeting the amygdala what we found with systemic injections. And the same result is found if we target CBP-beta. So if we disrupt this transcription factor in the amygdala now to a memory that is 2 days old, we see a disruption of the memory. But when memory is 2 weeks old, there is no effect. So second conclusion, There is a temporary gradient of protein synthesis and CB beta requirements following memory reactivation. A younger memory is more sensitive to disruption. Moreover, amygdala is a region or the region where these requirements are critical for the reconsolidation of inhibitory avoidance. Okay, what is the function of this post-retrieval labile phase? Why does memory become labile? And two functions have been suggested. The first one, the first hypothesis, is that reconsolidation mediates the formation of new associations that link new information with old retrieved memories. This is the way we update our memories. And the second hypothesis is that reconsolidation strengthens the memory itself. So we're going to try to address the first hypothesis by using a second-order conditioning paradigm. And in the second-order conditioning, we first start with the formation of a first-order conditioning, which is the classical association of a conditioned stimulus to an unconditioned stimulus. And then we're going to add a second conditioned stimulus that is going to make an association with the conditioned response created by the first conditioning. It's going to become clear when I explain to you the paradigm we used. Just before going into that, I want to say that we have used another set of knowledge here, of data that came available in the lab, and that is that when we disrupt CBP-beta, that transcription factor, in the amygdala around the time of training, and no matter when we tried, with single injection, double injections, many different times before and after, we have never seen an effect on memory. Memory was always present and normal. So the conclusion is that at all these time points, the function of the CBP-beta protein is dispensable for the consolidation of this memory. Okay, so just to summarize, the two pieces of data we're going to need here is that if we disrupt the function of CBP-beta in the hippocampus, we disrupt the consolidation process, the post-training process, but we spare the reconsolidation. And if we disrupt CBP-beta in the amygdala, we target the reconsolidation process, but we leave consolidation intact. So we have a way here to double dissociate the two mechanisms, the two processes, consolidation and reconsolidation. So what we're going to do here is to make a new association to a retrieved memory. And this is the second-order conditioning adapted to inhibitory avoidance. The rat is placed into the lead compartment in the context A. This is the door, and this is the dark side where it's going to get the shock. And there is a light into this context that is going to turn on. After this, the door is going to open, the rat walks into the dark side of the chamber, and it's going to get a food shock. And then we're going to place the rat in a different type of context. The walls are different, the floor is different, the smell is different, the room where these boxes are different. The only constant cue is that the light is going to turn on in context B. The door is closed, so they don't see the dark part of the chamber. Now, if the second order conditioning is going to occur, which means the light is going to remind of the first experience, then this rat is going to avoid context B once it's tested into this context. So we're going to test the animals, obviously, in both contexts and see what happens. And these are the data showing that, in fact, they do develop a conditioning, a fear conditioning for context B. So I'm going to repeat what the training is. The rats are placed in context A. The lights turn on. They go into the dark part of the chamber. They get a shock. And then they're going to be placed 2 days later, sometime later, they're going to be placed into a different context, context B, where the light will turn on. Or control groups are going to be placed in context B without the light, or remain in the home cages, and those are the non-reactivated groups. And then finally, at times wherever we want to, they're going to be tested in both contexts for the avoidance developed. And as you can see here, in red, you have the new memory, the memory for context B. you can see that this group have developed a very strong avoidance for context B. And this group is the one that has been trained in context A and reactivated in context B with the light. The other two groups, the control groups, without the light or not reactivated, remains with basically no significant latency, as they should. And obviously, the same rats, when they are tested in context A, whatever manipulation they're going to undergo during reactivation, they're going to have memory for context A. They have been trained there. And this memory is strong. If we retest them 7 days later, we see the same results. So it's long-lasting. Okay. So we are going to make a prediction here to test our hypothesis. If the reconsolidation of memory for context A mediates the formation of memory for context B, meaning the labile phase of memory, the reconsolidation is mediating the updating now, then memory for context B and memory for context A should be mechanistically linked. So when I disrupt the reconsolidation of the old memory, I will disrupt also the new memory, if that's the function. And which means to disrupt the reconsolidation, I'm going to inject the CBP beta blocker into the amygdala of these animals and disrupt the reconsolidation of the reactivated memory and see also if memory for context B is now gone. And what we found is not that. What we found is actually that memory for context B is perfectly normal. There is no effect of this manipulation. But what we disrupt is only the old memory. So we do disrupt the reconsolidation of the old memory, but the updating, the new association that is made of the new and the old, is intact. Here it is. These are the controls, and these are the animals that receive the blocker of the CBP beta. So what's going on? Is memory for context B undergoing a consolidation type of process? Is this a new memory? Is this a new association? If it is, it should be selectively affected by disrupting the CBP beta in the hippocampus. And that's what we found. Now, if we do disrupt CBP beta in the hippocampus, which we know disrupt consolidation of new memories, but not the reconsolidation of reactivated memories, what we find is that the new memory, the memory for context B, is disrupted completely, and the memory for context A, the old memory, is intact. So these two memories are completely dissociable and independent. So no, reconsolidation is not mediating memory updating or the new association to old memories. And this is our third conclusion. How much time? 5 minutes. Perfect. So I'm going to give you a flavor of which pathways mediates this stabilization during consolidation and reconsolidation. Well, I've introduced at the beginning the fact that stress is important for long-term memories and the stabilization of memories, and emotionally arousing events tend to be better remembered. And this suggests that the hormonal stress system is important for memory consolidation and reconsolidation. So we're going to test that. There is a lot of literature showing that stress, obviously, as I said, is important, it increases the strength of the memory, unless it's a very big stress. And in that case, we disrupt retention, and we also can disrupt memory consolidation. So there is actually an inverted U curve. But a little bit of stress is very good for memory. So we're going to test whether receptors for glucocorticoids, hormones, are important for consolidation and reconsolidation, so basically the stress pathways. And so we're going to use the same inhibitory avoidance training, and then we're going to inject in the hippocampi, in this case, immediately after, the RU38486. This is the abortion pill. It's a glucocorticoid receptor antagonist that blocks glucocorticoid receptors, now here in the hippocampus, and then we're going to test them 2 days later. And as you can see, the animals that receive the antagonist have an impaired memories compared to vehicle-injected controls, And this disruption is maintained 7 days after, if the animals are retested 7 days after. And memories does not come back even if animals are presented with a shock reminder. And this is a way to test whether memory is somewhere there. It's a way to test, for example, whether after extinction memory can return. And usually if we extinguish a memory and then we present a reminder, the memory will come back. Well, in this case, it doesn't. So we believe, as far as we can tell, that actually the information has been disrupted because we are not able to see a reinstatement, a return of the memory strength. If we do the same in amygdala after the retrieval of the memory, we see similar results. And so if now the animals are trained, 2 days later memory is retrieved, and now they receive into the amygdala the same antagonist, and as you can see, memory is impaired compared to controls, and the effect is stable and doesn't come back after a reminder shock. So glucocorticoid receptor antagonists administered following the reactivation of a traumatic memory and also following the training disrupt memory retention. These results may be useful, obviously, to think about potential direction for developing clinical trial in post-traumatic stress disorders. And I want to conclude by giving a working model that is an updated working model from a review I've written 3 years ago. We believe that consolidation actually takes a long time to be completed, weeks, months, or even years. And it occurs through rounds of trace stabilization evoked by both training and reactivation. And reconsolidation is a phase of the overall consolidation process because over time, memory becomes stronger and will become insensitive to the reconsolidation effect. So learning creates a trace. This trace begins a round of stabilization mediated by an initial modulation, for example, the stress hormones. And modulation phases are stabilization phases, molecularly, and are evoked by both initial learning and subsequent memory reactivations, reactivation of the traces over and over again, which can be either implicit, even during sleep, or explicit recall. And the stabilization of the memory trace is a function of the duration and number of these modulation phases. Each phase contributes to a gradient of stabilization that eventually will result in a fully consolidated trace that is insensitive to disruption. So reactivating a memory is actually a way to strengthen it. However, it will give an opportunity to this memory to make new associations. So reactivations, whether implicit or explicit, have at least two functions. They mediate memory stabilization, and they allow, but they do not mediate, the integration of new information with old memories. And I let you obviously conclude what kind of information this can be used in psychoanalytic directions. And I want to conclude by thanking the people who did the work. Maria Milekic was a graduate student in my lab, now a postdoc at Columbia, that together with Steven Taubenfeld, MD PhD student in my lab, worked on the initial molecular processes of memory consolidation, the CBP beta-dependent processes. Sophie Tronel, she's now a postdoc in Bordeaux. She did the work of the looking at updating of the memory, the second order conditioning. And Gabriella Polonini, who really helps everyone in the lab and the funding agency. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup, Christina, pour cette très belle présentation qui est ouverte pour une ou deux questions. Si vous êtes à l'aise, vous pouvez la poser en anglais. Sinon, vous pouvez la poser en français, puis je la traduirai. Là, il y a une question. Ah, oui, Suzanne.
Christina, thank you very much for this very, very nice presentation of a whole ensemble of extremely complex data and concepts in a very, very clear manner. So I congratulate.
Thank you, Susan. Well, she's a friend of mine, that's why.
So I thank you for that. But I have a question that I've been toying with for the past 25 or 30 years, so maybe you can. What is this behavior of the animal in passive avoidance test? What does it mean for you? Because we look at the data and we look at the statistics, and this animal has a memory impairment and this animal remembers. But it's not really like that. And what is it when an animal has a step through latency of 300 or 400 seconds out of 600, or even you said sometimes 900, what does that mean? Does that mean it forgets, it remembers a little bit, or compared to an animal with 100 seconds step through latency, which is already greater than he would have than a control animal? So is this a little bit of memory, or they just don't care, or the resolution of an approach avoidance, or maybe a retrieval deficit, a change in motivational properties? What actually is driving this behavior besides just the strength of the memory trace?
Yeah, well, we cannot ask the animal what's going on, obviously, as you know, but all we can measure is the behavior, the latency. And a number of parallel tests have shown that it's not motivation, it's not that they don't feel pain, it's not all that. And there is a relation between the strength of the latency and, for example, the shock intensity. And obviously there is an inverted U curve, as all these phenomenon. So there is a relation between the strength of the memory, the intensity of the painful experience, and also the maintenance, the length of the memory. So as far as we can tell, it reflects the intensity, if we want to call it that way, or the strength of the memory that is present in the animal, that is maintained in the animal. Now, we cannot ask the animal if it loses some of the memory and is significantly the latency is significantly less, whether there is a little bit of the memory. Obviously, the data suggests that there is a little bit of the memory, but it's much less, it's less strong. And so it's comparable to when we have a less intense memory. Perhaps what we are targeting here is the emotional component. We don't know, and these are experiments that are ongoing in the lab. Are we disrupting the emotional component of the association? Are we disrupting the contextual representation? Are we disrupting both when we do this type of manipulation? We don't know. These are experiments that are going in the lab.
Christina, j'aimerais te poser une question. Je la poserai aussi en anglais, disons en relation à la journée d'aujourd'hui. C'est-à-dire, en fait, ce processus de reconsolidation, comme tu l'as mentionné, peut prendre un intérêt dans le contexte de la psychothérapie au sens le plus large du terme. Donc, la réactivation d'une expérience, en fait, ce que tu montres, c'est qu'elle a deux faces. D'un côté, elle peut renforcer le souvenir de l'expérience, qui, si dans le contexte psychothérapeutique, au contraire, on voudrait peut-être rendre moins forte, mais en même temps, ça permet de réassocier éventuellement avec autre chose. Donc, en fait, comment tu vois ces mécanismes en relation à l'approche psychothérapeutique au sens large? Did you understand or should I translate?
I hope I did. Let's try. So reactivating the memories in a different settings. Every time we reactivate a memory in a new setting, as we have tried to model in some of these experiments, there is the opportunity to update. The memory today that is retrieved is not going to be the same as the memory that has been formed. And every retrieval and every elaboration are going to change and add new part that will become part of the trace. Now, we are going to have choices at this point. So it's not that the new memory is going to change the old memories, as we have seen here. So the old memory is present, If it's not reactivated, it's probably going to be forgotten. But whenever it's needed, we reactivate components of the memory trace, and these components are going to be strengthened, or they're going to be maintained for longer. When in the psychotherapeutic setting, we retrieve some of these components, those components are going to be strengthened, and they're going to be now making new associations. For example, through the elaboration that we have, through the new experience with the in the therapeutic settings. And now we're going to establish new traces, new part of the traces, and so we're going to form what is called a choice. We can react in the old ways, but we can also make possible new ways of dealing with the same experience.
Donc ce que tu dis, c'est que en fait les deux phénomènes, enfin expérimentaux évidemment, bon, ils sont indiscutables, mais que dans la pratique, cela voudrait dire que d'une part, c'est vrai, on renforce la trace, mais en même temps, on lui donne l'option de s'associer à autre chose et
right.
donc d'ouvrir à quelque chose de nouveau.
Right. There is also clinically thinking the opportunity to disrupt the original memories as memory becomes labile for a certain amount, length of time.
François.
Oui, je vais aussi, pour ceux qui parlent français comme moi, poser une question en français. Je pense que ce mécanisme de la reconsolidation, il est très intriguant et on l'a mis en jeu avec Pierre dans le modèle qu'on a construit sur la réassociation de traces. Dire que les traces, lors de l'évocation mnésique, deviennent labiles et susceptibles de nouvelles associations, c'est pourrait être vu comme un mécanisme central de la cure analytique. Comme le dit Pierre, évidemment, c'est à la fois les deux choses, renforcement et nouvelles associations, continuité et discontinuité. Mais enfin, ça peut être vu comme un mécanisme central et on donne beaucoup d'importance dans notre modèle. J'aurais une question sur le destin de la trace, parce que Freud disait... par exemple, dans Construction en psychanalyse, que rien ne se perd dans l'appareil psychique, qu'on a de la chance par rapport à l'archéologue, parce que tout est encore présent, même si c'est sous des formes inaccessibles. Alors, le destin de la trace dans la réassociation, est-ce que la trace primaire, elle est toujours existante, toujours présente, ou est-ce qu'elle est détruite dans le processus de la réassociation? Parce que ça a été dit, il y a un processus d'oubli, forgetting, mais
right.
est-ce que la trace elle-même, une fois réassociée, est toujours présente?
Right.
En d'autres
right.
termes, est-ce que, comme disait Freud, rien ne se perd dans l'appareil psychique ou tout se transforme?
Yeah, this is exactly what we have trying to test, at least in part, with these models. And is exactly that. So if, let's say we're talking about traumatic memories, obviously, Freud, and those are very strong memories, and he says they're going to dare to stay. And they do stay for a lifetime, because those are the types of memory I mentioned, it's very long-lasting memories. Now, when we reactivate parts of these memories, they make new associations. But these new associations are like new memories. So the original memory, even though it can undergo a process of reconsolidation at certain times, is not going to be disrupted by making new associations. However, the trace is going to make another level of associations and then other levels. And if you can think about throughout life, days and years, how many different associations we can make to the original trace, we can understand why by reactivating something that is not linked to the original memory, apparently, we can get to there. So this is probably the discontinuity that you were talking about. But the original memory is there to stay, unless it's going to be forgotten. And it's not going to be changed. It's going to be changed because there are new information linked to it, but it's not going to be disrupted by this process.
Dernière question ici.
Oui, une question clinique à propos du stress post-traumatique et des thérapies d'urgence, PTSD. Si j'ai bien compris, et ma question ce serait de vous demander si vous pensez qu'on peut l'étendre à l'homme, les résultats que... l'action psychothérapique telle qu'elle est modélisée ce matin et l'action pharmacologique dans les drames, les tremblements de terre, devraient être décalées, pas au même moment, ça c'est le premier bout de ma question, pas au même moment en termes d'heures, et peut-être qu'il faut commencer, je vous demande si vous le pensez, par l'action pharmacologique. Et la deuxième qui s'enchaîne, c'est est-ce que l'action pharmacologique protégerait des dangers du débriefing, puisqu'on a vu que souvent le débriefing pouvait être un aggravant et augmenter le risque de PTSD en augmentant la consolidation du traumatisme.
I need some help here.
The question is if after a major trauma,
yes,
one could envision two phases. The first one, pharmacological, early pharmacological intervention, and then also modulate the later intervention, because the debriefing
yes,
can actually worsen the,
right.
So can you comment on this?
Yeah, so actually we have a collaboration ongoing with psychiatrists at Mount Sinai that have been based initially on these experiments with the glucocorticoid receptor antagonist that disrupt memory reconsolidation of fear conditioning. And we have tested a number of parameters. For example, if we give this antagonist, now systemic, because obviously in people we cannot go into amygdala or hippocampus, they do work. And we have looked at the time, the best time of administration. So it goes a little bit in where you go. So debriefing can worsen the symptoms. And it can worsen because it's a reactivation without disruptive intervention. Actually, there is an interesting relationship between the time of intervention and the intensity of the trauma, the intensity of the shock in our case. The stronger the shock is, the more resistant the memory becomes, even at very early times. So we need to wait some time, like a week or so, and then give the reactivation, if you wish, the debriefing, with the pharmacological intervention, and then we see a disruptive effect. If we do it right away, a day or two after the shocking, the traumatic experience, we actually cannot disrupt it. However, we cannot wait too long because the memory becomes too strong. And as I showed you, the longer you wait, the memory, the more strong the memory becomes. So there is a time window during which the memory is more susceptible to disruption after debriefing. So they have developed a clinical trial and they are testing PTSD subjects with this type of approaches.
Voilà, merci beaucoup. Je propose qu'on se retrouve à 10h20 précise.